The following class was led by Steve Hagen at Dharmafield Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on June 12, 2000. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good evening. Welcome to our class on egolessness. It's an interesting topic, don't you think, for all of us with egos, huh? Egolessness. interesting subject. I'm glad to see this much interest in it. Also, I'm very happy to have the opportunity to present my teacher's teaching on this very important topic of egolessness, which I think most of you know is very central to Buddhist teachings. The no-self teaching of the Buddha. Very difficult to understand, and sometimes we can look at it, as we do actually in the classes, in pretty technical terms. Here we're going to be looking at it in a little bit more, free and easy terms, kind of just everyday situations, perhaps, more than usual. But egolessness, Just saying that alone might be a little difficult for us to appreciate. Can you think of another word for egolessness? If we were just to take that idea and put it into another word, what would you say? Can you come up with something else?
Non-self.
Non-self? Yeah. Of course, non-self is kind of like non-ego, and non-ego is... So we've said pretty much the same thing again. But what exactly does this mean in practical terms in our everyday life? And I think there is a word to remember. And if you don't get anything else out of this course, remember this word. Egolessness is, in terms of our everyday life, practical living, you know, from day to day, egolessness is happiness. Happiness is egolessness. It is the same thing. To the extent that we are not happy, we are discontent in some way. This, if you look, you'll see that your ego is wrapped up in that situation. That if we can live in a way where we're not calculating everything according to ourselves, our own likes or dislikes, all of that, weighing everything out, here we have a chance to find some happiness. So if you don't remember anything else from this course, just try to bear that in mind. I think it'll help you a great deal. Especially those times when you find yourself getting caught up in frustration and anger and a difficulty of various sorts. Remember what the true ticket to happiness is. Don't take yourself so seriously. This confusion that we have regarding self. Sometimes can kind of backfire on us. Our normal way of looking at this, I think, it can kind of backfire on us. And I just thought of it today as I was thinking about tonight's talk. I remember this line from Woody Allen, which kind of gives us the backfiring here. He said, he said, "I'm not afraid of death." He said, "I just don't want to be there when it happens." And it's the same kind of thing. That's our usual thinking, but just pushed in the reverse direction. Because we do see ourselves as here. And of course, one of the things that will show up, we can suppose, is death. And of course, we don't want to be here. And when it happens, on the other hand, all of that good stuff that happens, I want to be here for that. We think like this. And we think that somehow this is how we'll find happiness, you know, by being here. And if we forget ourselves, that somehow happiness will depart and leave. Well, it doesn't depart and leave. In fact, that is the only way that we actually can truly find happiness. And at the same time, too, the big trauma that we have about this problem of death that Woody Allen points out, that ceases to be a problem. So from both sides... egolessness, if you can find that, is a very sane, happy way to live. It also puts us in touch with what is really going on, far more than our abstracted notions about self and walling ourselves off in our own little selfhood. Well, I'm going to start tonight on page 72. It's a little ways into this section. Oh, by the way, I should say, too, that we'll be going through the middle section of Katagiri Roshi's book, You Have to Say Something, this section on egolessness. And I think we'll be taking roughly 10 pages a time, so that'll get us through this section this summer. And I'll just be reading passages here and there and making some comments along the way. But I want to begin on into the section there a little ways on page 72 in this little section called Egolessness. Katagiri Roshi says in the first paragraphs, in the first paragraph, nothing lasts. The last line is, if this is true, how should we live? And then he says, in egolessness. Nothing lasts. So this is the experience of our lives, that nothing holds still for a moment. Nothing lasts. Not ourselves, not our situation, the things that we love, the things that we hate. Nothing lasts. So how should we live according to this, if this is true? And, of course, we shouldn't just swallow that idea that this is true, but I think if we just look very carefully at our lives, we can realize that this is the case, that nothing lasts. Then how should we live? He says, in egolessness. Egolessness is living in a way that is compatible with the fact that nothing lasts, because if you look at what an ego is something that lasts. An ego is something that persists from moment to moment. That's what the self is. Of course, it's an imagined thing. We actually don't find such a thing in our experience if we look very carefully. We think we do because we're caught up in our thinking. We're caught up in our conceptualizing, which is to freeze the world into various things. And so we have this notion of a self, an ego. But this notion that we have about selfhood is out of step with what is actually taking place, because what is actually taking place is that nothing lasts. And so this ego, this sense of ego that we have, the sense of I, doesn't actually match any part of reality or any part of our experience. And this is the basic reason, then, why this entangles us in all kinds of unhappiness and sorrow and confusion, longing and loathing. It's basically because we are out of step with reality. So if this is true, how should we live in egolessness? Egolessness is not about destroying or ignoring the subjective side of life. A very important point. So this isn't, when we talk about egolessness, we might think that this is about, I don't know, marginalizing ourselves or putting ourselves down or shutting ourselves out or something of that sort. That is not the case. It is not about destroying or ignoring the subjective side of life. It means noticing that subjectivity is intimately related to what appears out there. In other words, both the subject, me, and the object, that, exist together beyond our likes and dislikes. So this is a direct pointing to what our actual experience of this life is and what this moment is. A little further down, he says, usually we see things from our own point of view, according to our preconceptions, emotions, and preferences. We then try to manipulate and control things, the things that we see. Well, this is our problem, that we want to control, we want to manipulate. But if you just consider this for a moment, I think maybe you can see already the entanglements here and the difficulties here that we face. The excessive concern about controlling things, and that which we try to control is that which we have no control over generally. That part of our experience that we do have an enormous control over, mainly our own minds, just watching ourselves, in other words, not controlling our minds as such, but just attending to what is taking place within our own mind. That part we tend to ignore. We tend to ignore how we are living from moment to moment. And we're always casting ourselves out there somewhere. Further down he says, if you bring your personal point of view even slightly, if you bring in your personal point of view even slightly, you immediately create a gap. This is the gap at times, I think maybe some of you heard me say, this is his famous phrase, through which a cold wind blows, a gap. And this gap is hatred, aversion, anger, and suddenly life becomes pretty hard for us. So if you bring your own personal agenda into matters to that extent, you have set yourself up for these three poisons here, poisons of the mind, hatred, aversion, anger. These are all three versions of, but it's also greed, aversion and greed are there. Of course, the other poison is the fact that we are confused about self. But this makes life pretty hard for us, he says. The world is beyond our likes and dislikes. This is reality. And to the extent that we think we can control a situation to always have what we like showing up, to the extent that we think that we can control things so that what we don't like never shows up, this is just wasting our time, wasting our energy, trying to control all of that out there, which we cannot control, all the while attending and ignoring, not attending to and ignoring that area that we can do something about, and that is observing our own attitude and our own mind and our own approach to life and getting in touch with what is actually taking place in reality. Any questions about that? I think that's probably a pretty good intro to what we're going to be looking at in this course. And then going back to the beginning of this section, by the way, just interrupt me though. I know this is a pretty large class, so you might be a little intimidated to ask questions, but you know, if you have a question, we can pause. I think there's probably plenty of time here. Starting then at the beginning of this section on egolessness on page 65, the section, Where Are You Now? Said Dogen Zenji, a great Japanese Zen master, very important teacher in our school, the school that Katagiri Roshi taught in the Soto school in Japan. Dogen Zenji compared our life to rowing a boat. He said it is the place where you are, who's rowing this boat. The place where you are is very important, but most people don't pay attention to it. So this is just what we were discussing here. We don't pay attention to just where we are. And this has a great deal to do with your own mind, your own cast of mind. So it is very important if we want to find this happiness, this happy way of life, this sane way of life, we have to get in touch with what is actually taking place, and that what we find in immediacy. We don't find it in that world out there, which we have mostly abstracted in our minds and set apart. So he says that we need to, it's very important that we pay attention to where we are. He said the place where you are is not just your place. This is another big clue here. He says if you actually see where you are, you see that you are one with the boat, the water, the near shore, and the far shore. You are one with the sky, the birds, and the motion of the boat. In other words, you, the boat, the water, the near and far shores, and the sky are all moving together. Where you are is completely beyond your control, and yet you still have to row the boat. So it's, even though it's completely beyond your control, you still have to row the boat. In other words, you still have to attend to this moment and taking care of this moment. And yet, that whole situation that you are in, you're in it, you're a part of it, you're inseparable from it. It is not something that is really within your control. Even the things that seem to be on the subjective side of things are not all that much in our control. But what is in our control is our ability to turn our attention to this immediate moment and just see what is taking place within this moment. We don't think that that's enough. We think that we need to do something more. Well, of course, maybe we will. Maybe we can do something more. But if we don't have the awareness of what is actually happening in this moment, whatever it is that we think we need to do won't really match reality. And it gets us into trouble once again. So he says, if you think that you can accomplish everything just by your own effort, you are ignoring the fact that you are already one with the boat, already on the boat with all beings. If you believe that everything you need to do can be done just by your personal efforts, you will eventually fall into desperation. He says a little further down, then you might think of yourself as a failure. This is a common feeling people get when they ignore the most important place, the place where they actually are. So if you see your life, basically what he's talking about here, if we just see our lives in the large context instead of according to our own little point of view, then we don't get into these kinds of troubles. And this is called forgetting the self. On the next page, yes?
No, the part about you have no control and all that, it struck me that it flies in the face of a lot of, for lack of a better term, New Age thinking, kind of mind techniques
to
influence the outcome.
I might get into that a little further here. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A lot of us who come to these kind of classes, maybe we're,
You were doing, yeah.
Stuff too,
mm-hmm.
So
yeah. Well, see, the then you came here then, so you keep on looking, see. But this is the end of the road. if you understand it. But in fact, I was just going to get to something like this in just a moment here. This is a very important point. I'm getting to it right now. He said that on the top of page 66, he said, you can't touch anything real just by your own effort. It's a pretty interesting statement, isn't it? If you're operating just out of your own agenda, if you're working on one of these self-help kind of programs or whatever, so you can get your own program really going, great. But you can't touch anything real that way, according to Katagiri Roshi. He said, if you try to touch what is real, immediately you fall into delusion. Why? Why would you fall into delusion if you try to touch what is real? Trying to touch your nose with your nose, right? So what are you doing then? If in fact you're trying to touch something real, isn't real? Well, of course, you're always touching something real, so it doesn't really matter. But if you try to do this, what's the confusion here? What's the difficulty?
We're creating separation.
We're creating an ego. An ego is something that's separate. We're creating something that is existing apart from reality. But you don't exist apart from reality. Nothing does. And what is reality? It's nothing in particular that persists from moment to moment. It is this constant flux and flow and change. So if you try to do this, you're basically just trying to grasp. You're just taking a conceptual a take on the world and on your experience. And he says immediately you fall into delusion. Immediately this is delusion. This is to be caught up in delusion. And then in this delusion, we try to straighten everything out, get the right program going here, and then we'll straighten everything out, instead of just attending to what is actually taking place. And if we understand what is actually taking place, we're not in a lot of confusion. And whatever it is that we have to do from moment to moment, it is pretty clear and obvious. There isn't any pat answer for it, really. But then there's this danger. He said in San Francisco in 1960, he talked about the hippies on the streetcar there. And he asked the fellow, where are you going? He says, I don't know. Just ask the streetcar. And so he said, this was the usual understanding of Zen in those days. It's pretty nice, don't you think? Yeah, it's nice, of course. You know, just, get on the streetcar and there you go. But he says, nice and soft, like a downy cushion. But it's really a big misunderstanding. It is to forget that you are already in the water and that you have to row the boat. If you just depend on, where he says, if you don't know where you are headed and you just depend on the boat, you are completely confused. If you don't know where you're headed and you just depend on the boat, he said. If you just depend on the current waves in our culture, in our society, the fads and fashions that come sweeping through, if you just depend on that to carry you along, if you just depend on, you know, the passing fancies of this moment, or the, you know, the pop culture, or the, you know, the things, if you're depending on that, rather than seeing the whole situation in which you exist, and realizing that you have to take care of your life from day to day, just taking one step at a time, then we're completely confused, and we go looking for something else apart from ourselves that's going to straighten us up, rather than realizing that if you would just get in touch with what is actually taking place here right now, that is your straightening up. That is all the straightening up you need. That you already have the capacity, the ability, all the equipment you need to take care of your life right now in this very moment. That you do not need to look out there for something else. If you just depend on the boat, of course, we do depend on other things, on the truckers that haul the vegetables to market, and the medical establishment, and many other things. There's all kinds of things that we depend on. But at the same time, we have to live our lives deliberately and consciously and step into it. We have to row the boat ourselves. So it's both these things going on at once. But look for the stability. Look for that thing that will sustain you. It is already right here at hand. You don't need to reach out there for something else, as if somehow you're lacking or missing something, or that you need to fix yourself up. What you need to do is just awaken. Just see what is going on. He said Dogen's message is very important for us. It is really a great opportunity to see human life from a broader perspective. And this is the heart of our practice. It is to see our lives together with all beings. And this is a very important point. He'll get into this a little more further on, this reality that we don't live our lives as a separate self. He says, throw yourself away. Next section, he says, in learning who and what you are, you realize how your ego consciousness corroborates what you're doing. You ever notice that? Ego consciousness appears on the surface of your daily life. Yes, I am doing Zazen, or I want to do Zazen. Or, you know, we're kind of explaining to ourselves what we are doing. But this is always going on the surface. Maybe we also offer some justification for what it is that we are doing. And, you know, just continuously defining ourselves in each moment as we go along. Ego consciousness, he says, may seem to be strong, but it's actually very weak. Ego consciousness it seems to be strong. It's just like, I'll tell this to cancer patients. Sometimes I've worked with people with cancer. And cancer is something that if you've ever had it, it'll feel like it's something. If you're not watching, if you're not paying careful attention, it'll seem like something that's very strong, you know, and it's going to get you, you know, and it's got a lot of power. Well, it looks like something like that, but actually, if you consider what cancer is something that is really very weak. It's a disorganized cell, and it doesn't have any defense. The only thing that it does well is make more cancer cells, and it's just doing this over and over again. But it has virtually no defense. It can be attacked by all kinds of means. And one of the ways that we can deal with cancer is just simply to recognize that and to realize that we have certain defenses all within our own mind and body, and that we can use to defend ourselves in this way. Of course, we might need some other kinds of help along the way as well. But the point I'm trying to make is that we shouldn't be, you know, cowed, you know, by that circumstance. Same thing, too, with this ego consciousness. Somehow we become even cowed by this ego consciousness. It seems to be something very strong. Our personal desire for this or that, it just seems to be something that we can't overcome. It's just too strong. And it, like he says, it always keeps us going to the right and to the left. He says your ego consciousness realizes, he says, but finally he realizes that there's nothing to say. We reach this this impasse, he talks about. Well, that's a kind of weakness then, right? Because the ego, in all of this striving and straining and struggling, it never accomplishes anything, really, for itself. It's never able to sustain itself. It's never able to keep itself going. Sooner or later, it arrives at this end. Or either that, or it just keeps thrashing about for the rest of our time here. But if we look at this very carefully, we realize very much like a cancer cell, it isn't really accomplishing anything. Isn't really getting anywhere. It doesn't reveal anything about the truth to us. It doesn't reveal anything about reality. It embeds us in all kinds of frustrations and confusion instead. And it never sorts any of this out for us. We might think along the way that we're getting things sorted out from time to time, but in fact, every night when we go to bed, we realize we don't understand what's going on. You know, if you think about it, you just kind of quiet down there. It's kind of like that. So, but at some point, if you just stay with this ego mind, you watch it thrashing about, going from the right to the left and every which way, he said that you will realize, you come to this nothing to say, that there's nothing to say. And he says you reach an impasse. As long as you try to figure out what to do, that's our usual way, the situation will get worse, he says. And this is usually what we try to do. Just to give you one example of how the situation gets worse is just look at the human world. Look at all the things that we're doing to the human world and for ourselves in the human world. And it's like we're improving it and improving it and improving it, but at the same time, we start to wonder if we're going to survive. You know, what are we doing to this planet, and what are we doing to each other? And what about the crime and the pollution and the disease? You read Laurie Garrett's The Coming Plague and all of this stuff that's, you know, happening in medicine and that sort of thing, using antibiotics and things, and now we're sitting here right on a threshold of all kinds of germs and diseases that we won't be able to stave off any longer because of all of our tamperings and things. And I can go on. Many different things that we do. Because we want to improve our situation and create refrigeration or whatever, now we have the ozone hole opening up in the atmosphere. And so in other words, with all of our doing, with all of our struggling and striving and trying to improve and thrashing about from here to there, it's very questionable that we're really accomplishing anything. And it seems like if we just look at the human life, how miserable so many people are, how confused we are, how frightened we are, how many of us actually find peace of mind or actually know any kind of sanity or have any sense of where we are, where we're going, where we've been, any of this sort of thing, or what human life is about. In the end, we don't have any of these things answered. We look for any kind of wisdom that we find within our life, and we don't seem, it seems like wisdom is a light that just seems like it's gone out for the most part. And we have all kinds of struggles for you know, power and self-gratification, all the rest of it. This is the human world. This is our trying to figure it out and trying to improve the situation. All the while, we don't learn, nobody's ever taught us to just sit down and pay attention to what is going on right here in this moment. This isn't to say that we shouldn't make this effort to do that or to do this. Certainly we have to do things to take care of our lives. But at the same time, if what's driving us is something that is abstract and out there, and that we're constantly relating to that, whatever that happens to be, and never looking at ourselves and at our own minds and how we're actually living from moment to moment and seeing what the true secret of happiness is and sanity and peace, we're never going to find anything. We're never going to improve anything. We're never going to set up the world in such a way that we don't scare ourselves to death, wondering if we're going to even survive our own ingenuity as we do right now. So if you look very carefully then at what you're doing, you will come to this impasse, as Katagiri Roshi says. And at that point, we just sit down. He said, we come to this impasse. This impasse is to do zazen, he says. And on page 67, further down, he said that zazen, but this, I was going to say about this, to do this zazen, but this isn't to sit down in some kind of defeated attitude. This is a very important point, because if you were to sit down in some kind of defeated attitude, then that is to presume that all of this stuff that I mean, all these difficulties and woes and sorrows and confusions that I was kind of listing here, are real, are substantial. They're like waves on the water. If we stop blowing, maybe it's waves on our own little teacup. If we stop blowing, they'll settle down. And we have to learn to do this. Of course, you can do it for your own life, and maybe if you learn to do it, maybe a few other people can learn to do it. It would be nice if we as a species can learn to do this. It doesn't mean to fall into inaction or to sit down in some kind of defeat. It just simply means to regain your sanity and to come back to this moment and to see what is actually taking place. So a little further down, he says, Zazen is not a means to an end or an escape or the promise of reward. Neither is it a matter of figuring out the meaning of the impasse. Zazen, by the way, for those of you who are new to this this place and these classes, Zazen just simply means sitting meditation. Zen is just simply means meditation. It means to sit down and to take note of what is actually happening here in this moment. And this is what he means by Zazen here. Zazen is to return to the original nature of the self based on emptiness. And the self based on emptiness is the fact that this self, this solid real being that we think is there, is actually something that we cannot grasp, something we cannot find, something we cannot define. And it is empty. What we have, the reality of our lives, is empty of anything of this sort. It is empty of solidity. It is empty of a particular identity. We always want to dress ourselves in some particular identity, saying I'm like this or I'm like that, or we want to identify with something or another. But in fact, that is just to create kind of an empty shell, you know. And then we fill it up with all kinds of ideas. But in fact, none of this ever actually matches reality, because we don't find anything that isn't changing. That nothing holds still even for a moment. This is the realization of emptiness. And we can return to this original nature of the self, which is based on emptiness, meaning that this has nothing to do with you at all, as we're going to find out when we get a little further into this. That the true self that you are is inseparable from the world in which you find yourself. He says, if you deeply understand human life, there is nothing to say. In other words, kind of interesting, right in the middle of a book where you have to say something. But if you deeply understand human life, there is nothing to say. In other words, the original nature of the self is not some idea in your mind. The sanity, the reality that we can come to if we arrive at this impasse is not some idea. It is not to once again take hold of something as an answer, something that is going to sustain us. We might want to know, well, what is this like? You know, what Katagiri Roshi is speaking of here. But then once again, if you'll notice, it is just once again to try to form some kind of idea. We should learn to recognize that within ourselves. To merge with Zazen, he says a little further down, is not so easy. It requires strong determination. To not hold yourself separate from this settling down, this I am doing Zazen or I want to do Zazen. Just settle down in this moment itself, forgetting the self. Further down, he says, oneness with Zazen implies no meddling. No meddling. This is what we are very good at. Can you just sit down and not meddle? Huh? Those of you who tried it, you just sit down, and of course the mind becomes very busy, it's very agitated, it's constantly jumping about, reaching for this or that. Once in a while it even reaches for, I don't want to sit down here, I want to stand up, I want to do something. But this is to meddle. We're always meddling. We're meddling first before we just sit down and recognize what is actually taking place here. Oneness with a Zazen implies no meddling. It means no idea of practice and no idea of practicer. To truly sit down here, to truly do what Katagiri Roshi is saying, to truly enter into this moment, is not to enter into this moment with the notion of I am entering into this moment. The notion of I am entering into this moment is to keep yourself apart from this moment. It is not to settle down. If you truly do Zazen, very naturally the idea of practicer and the idea of Zazen will drop off. Then you will be free of Zazen. So this is very important in our meditation. For those of you actively engaged in a practice of meditation, you should recognize this. And just wholeheartedly engage the practice of meditation without any idea of who is practicing, what it is that you are doing, and what it is that you're getting from this. All of these things are to remove yourself from this moment. It's to set yourself. Distraction is to immediately launch yourself into a dissatisfied mind. A mind that is reaching for something, a mind that is trying to get something. This is not to do Zazen. And this is also not to be free of Zazen. Also to have some lofty ideas about, you know, what a good Zazen practitioner I am or something like this, you know. Or the other way around, what a lousy Zazen practitioner I am. You know, any of these kinds of things at all are to remove ourselves. And also to be bound by Zazen. Again, Zazen isn't sitting down in the cross-legged posture such as I'm sitting now, or even sitting in a chair and doing the meditation. He is really speaking of just settling down, coming into this moment, realizing your own state of mind and what is taking place now, and recognizing that reaching, screaming, controlling hand of our own mind that is trying to shape the world according to our likes and dislikes. Okay. Any questions about any of this? Because I'm really now getting to the section I really want to talk on. I have just enough time here, I think. Opening your heart. Opening your heart. This is wonderful. Katagiri Roshi said, we tend to live in terms of me. But if you're interested in the spiritual life, what would the spiritual life be? Spiritual life would be happiness. If you're interested in happiness, okay, we could put that there. If you're interested in the spiritual life, you will have to consider more than just yourself. He said, you will have to. And if you don't like the term spiritual life, just think of happiness, because it's the same thing. The spiritual life is all about happiness. And when I say happiness, too, I don't mean the grinning, smiley-faced happiness. I mean a kind of stability and tranquility of mind, a calmness of mind, a rationality of mind, a sanity of mind. I'm talking about that rather than some kind of warm puppy sort of thing. God, the warm puppies are fine. But, okay, so if you're interested in the spiritual life, you will have to consider more than yourself. And he means this. And this is the law. This is reality. This is just how it is. It isn't that, I mean, he's pointing this out, but it isn't like he's dictating this, now we ought to believe it. Just take a look very carefully at your life, and you'll realize that this is just how the universe is set up. It's just made this way. So you have to consider more than yourself. Further down, he says that we have to continue to seek a world based on the practice of openness of heart. Perfect openness of heart brings into life flexibility, tenderness, and magnanimity. This can't be fully explained conceptually. This can't be fully explained. But of course, we always want things explained, or we like to explain things to ourselves as well. And then we get caught up in the explaining. We get caught up in the rationalizing and the defining and all the rest of that. All the while not recognizing that there's something very, very warm, friendly, intimate, magnanimous, that is all being cut away, all within, you know, our own fiber, our own life, our own heart. He said, you can't put your fingers, this can't be fully explained, this tenderness and magnanimity, cannot be fully explained conceptually. You can't put your finger on it, but you can feel it. And we need to sensitize ourselves to, and what he's talking about is what's actually happening in this moment. When you say something or you do something where suddenly the world becomes kind of brittle and cold, and we're not paying careful attention to this, we're not paying careful attention to the actual reality of this moment and the situation that we are creating. He said, you can't put your finger on it, but you can feel it. To live this way is what you are really looking for. With all of the self-help kind of stuff that we go seeking after, you know, all of that out there, you don't need any of that. What we need to do is to settle down and to see what it is that we are doing. And what it is that we are after is not something that we can actually explain or anything we can really put our finger on. But what is it? To live this way is what you're really... To live this way is to take it to heart, to live deliberately, just step right into your life and take it up wholeheartedly. Not looking around at others, not trying to get ahead or to not do your part or whatever, to lag behind, but just to fully engage in each moment from moment to moment, all the while training yourself, learning to see. What is going on within your own mind? This constant screaming, dictating mind that we carry around with us, that we tend to ignore. That is the part that is really giving us a lot of trouble. He said, usually we live our lives only in terms of the world that we can see. Usually we live our lives only according to the world that we conceptualize, the world that we have explained to ourselves, in other words. When we do, we emphasize ourselves, because if you... Whatever you see out there, you see that thing out there, and immediately, of course, now you see yourself in distinction to that thing out there, and very often in opposition to it. So he says, when we're living our lives only according to what we see, we emphasize ourselves. We place the I first. This is very usual for us. This is our usual way, constantly placing the I first. Maybe we don't notice that we're doing this. Of course, we have a phrase, don't we? I don't hear it so much anymore, but looking out for number one kind of idea. Ticket to misery. We think that way because we think this will make us happy. It doesn't. And it also not only makes our own lives miserable, it messes up the world and scares everybody else. So it doesn't really, you know, help to live that way. But we place the I first. Even when we take up the spiritual life, we place the I first. Even when we take up this... In other words, we put everything down to the level of our personal views and feelings. We never forget ourselves. And this is true even in spiritual practice and spiritual teachings. And people that will take the Zen teachings and use them in a particular way, drive them, steer them from a particular standpoint, as if these teachings had some kind of origin, as if there was some point source for these teachings, as if they come from a particular agenda, or that you can apply them somehow to your own personal agenda. Well, maybe you can, but if you do, what you've just grabbed and what you're using is just your own delusion, and you're only dealing with your own selfish mind. That these teachings and what Katagiri Roshi is speaking of here and trying to draw our attention to is something that you can't even tell where it's coming from. It's not coming from any particular locality. It is coming out of the universe itself. It is coming from all directions and arriving here and dispersing itself back to the universe in all directions. It is something large and magnanimous. It is not something small. And to the extent that we hear things in those terms, always putting it in relation to me, and then how can I use this and that, we are, if you just look immediately, you will see greediness there, frustration, and dissatisfaction and not getting what you want. But we even do this in terms of the spiritual life, entering into a life of meditation. Probably we put on the robes of the priest or whatever, here the home leaving that we have here. Some people want to go into further training. We can fall into this, and it is very dangerous. And it is just living your life in the usual, ordinary way. It is not truly the spiritual life. But this is what we tend to do, and we should be watching for it. We never forget ourselves. This is why at bottom we are often irritated or uneasy. The more we place this I first, the more irritation and uneasiness and suffering and fear we feel. What we tend to ignore is the world that sees us. This is an important point. We're always caught up in the world that we see. We ignore the world that sees us. This is not the world you think you see or hear. This is not the world that is in the world that sees us is not an object. It doesn't have any particular point or source. It is from all directions. We cannot put our finger on it, as we were talking about a little bit earlier. But we ignore this. We ignore this because it isn't a definite point, or this, it isn't something we can definitely point to. But it's reality. The stuff we point to is just stuff that we've fractured and divided off one from another, and it's not actually real, because nothing actually exists apart from other. Everything exists in the whole context here. It is the whole context itself that is actually the reality. And this is the world that sees us, is the way he's phrasing it here. But it's not the world that we think we see in here. What we see in here, of course, is just our ideas, our thoughts, the things that we've conceptualized and separated from ourselves. He says, nevertheless, you are supported by this world that that sees us. It is actually the world as it is before we are conscious of it, the world of the one mind, before you form some idea about it. He says, if you emphasize yourself, you will completely forget this world. You'd be oblivious to it. You won't even notice that this world. He says, you will forget this world that sees, holds, and sustains you. You will forget reality, in other words. You will be caught up once again in the petty self. And then he gives this example, being a Zen master here at the Zen Center, and he was, every day he had to keep the schedule. And now I have the privilege of understanding what that's like, and but it's wonderful, even though you hate it. And but like he says here, he's got to get up every morning and that sort of thing, whether he wants to or not, because I know him. He doesn't. He's beyond that. I mean, you might have these petty little things. We were talking about this at the. We had a 7-day sesshin just recently, we were talking about that, especially at the beginning. When you're starting something like that, it's pretty daunting, And nobody likes it. I confessed, I don't like it either, I don't like it any more than anybody else, But on the other hand, at the same time, there's some wonderful aspects to it too, you know. So I love it, you know. Well, then, do I love it or do I hate it? You know, we here's the mind's going this way and going that way, and it's like we have to figure something out. But usually we're living our lives, and if we're not paying attention to the world that sees us, these things become big and uncontrollable, and they just drive us all over the place. And it is very difficult to live your life that way. But if you put your mind in this larger context and realize the world that sees you, you're not tossed about in this way. So this stuff that, well, I love that, no, I hate that, I don't like that, you know, all these things, they go on, but they become very small. And they don't control you. At the same time, then you can find the actual background of mind, your mind, which is very quiet, very stable, very peaceful. It is right there for each one of us. We can find it and tap into it and realize that that is actually our true mind. And do not think that these problems that Kagiri Roshi is, expressing here, well, I don't want to follow a sketch or whatever, but then he does. He puts himself in and he just does it. I don't think that a person like that is different than you or is made of some other kind of fabric than you. He is not. And this is a very important point, because if you think the teacher is something different, something qualitatively different than what you are, then you will never learn what it is that the teacher is trying to show you. You have to realize that we're all pretty much made of the same stuff. Of course, he says, we all have this little voice in us that says, don't tell me what I should do. Yeah, we all know that. But we can't take care of our lives very well just based on our personal preferences. Now, this might be news to you or not, but if it is, consider it carefully. Those of you who have mulled this one over, really take it to heart. And look at this and realize how this is true. And there is no negotiating this point. If you base your life on your personal preferences, contrary to what it is you're trying to succeed in doing, you make yourself miserable. If you kind of set all that aside, you'll notice the stuff you love shows up anyway. Of course, the stuff you hate shows up anyway. But that's going on no matter what you do. That'll go on. You don't need to waste all your time and energy trying to, arrange all of that stuff. It just goes on. In the meantime, then this screaming little voice becomes smaller and smaller, and it doesn't leave, I suppose. It's still there, Once in a while, I don't feel like getting up for Zazen, but it doesn't matter. I know I'm going to, and so it doesn't matter. Other times, I might get up like a fool, thinking, well, this is wonderful, getting up so early, and it's just, especially now, this time of year, birds are singing, it's wonderful, But that's just kind of an insanity, I just enjoy the birds and walk over here and not get too carried away. But that's all we need to do. So whether we hate it or we love it, just find the stability and enjoy what's enjoyable and enjoy what's not so enjoyable. And you can really do that. But he said there's you can't live your life just based on your personal preferences. There's a big world that sees you. You can't ignore this world. And to the extent that you tune in and realize that there is this big world that sees you, to that extent, you will find a stability, happiness, and peace of mind, and tranquility of mind. And then you can carry on your life, do the things you need to do, and take care of. But you can take care of these on the basis of sanity, and not on the basis of in the large context, and not on the basis of some petty concern that only leads to frustration. It says, if you want to practice compassion, another interesting point here, then you must accept simultaneously the world that sees you and the world you see and the world that sees you. Both the world that you see and the world that sees you, if you want to practice compassion, because if you practice compassion only out of the world you see, then it isn't really true compassion. It says further down here, what does he say? Maybe I'm thinking of another passage. I think I am. But if you have this idea about compassion and how you're going to be compassionate, you're going to do something for others or whatever. That's right. In another context, he points out how this is actually just once again our ego operating. Just do it completely with total openness of heart. He said, compassion is like spring water under the ground. You know, all we have to do is tap into it, seeing ourselves in the large context. On the last page, on page 70 of this section, he says, forgetting yourself does not mean destroying yourself. This is a very important point. Because if we think that that's what we're talking about, then of course this wouldn't be a particularly healthy thing to involve yourself with. Forgetting yourself does not mean destroying yourself. Forgetting yourself is just to see yourself from a different angle, the way the world sees you. Then you will see not just your little ego self, but your true self, your big self, which includes all beings. And this is what we truly are. We are not a separate ego divided off from others. The lives that we live are the lives of the world, or the life of the world, I should say. That we actually live together, one life together with all beings. Well, I actually wanted to get to the using the selfish self. I had a cute little story about my teacher, but I'll have to save it for next week. We'll pick it up from there. We do have a minute or two. Do you have any questions, anybody?
I have a question. Part about putting the self first, leading basically to trouble and aggravation and such. Would it be fair to say that really if you do the same with any other particular person, or perhaps any other particular, it's really just another variation on that same thing?
You just don't put any particular first. First, step outside of that. You know, don't get locked in the small, fragmented world. And Zen training is all about just doing that. I mean, it's really when it comes down to it, this is what we are learning to do, is to recognize this own, this petty little self that we have. We all have this, you know. But learn to see how this gets us entangled in all kinds of difficulty and confusion. And it never, like I said earlier, it never sorts anything out for us. We never seem to, you know, settle on anything. And all the while, like we look at the human world, it's frightening what we're doing, you know, what we're doing even to our whole planet now, because we're so clever and we're so powerful, you know, with our, you know, with our hands and our minds and the way we use them. So we need to be doing something else first, you know. Of course, we need to take care of the world and take care of ourselves and take care of each other, and we need to build roads and bridges and all the rest of it. But first, the part that we need to do first, we ignore. And when we have to become sane first. We have to, you know, realize that our true lives are in this fabric of reality and not just caught up in our own petty little selves that we can never satisfy. And to the extent, right on the face of it, to the extent that we... that is the focus of our lives. We are miserable, and we cannot satisfy that misery. You know, so this in a nutshell, this is what we are looking at here. And as we go through this, we'll be just be looking at all different, looking at this from all different angles, and the subtlety with which, you know, we get entangled in all these different kinds of confusions is profound. But this is a very, very important point. And it's a matter of just learning to exercise this, you know, coming back to reality in each moment. This is what the Zen meditation is about. It's just to bring ourselves back, to just settle down, calm yourself down, and just settle down and see what is taking place here. Most of all, first start recognizing what's going on within your own mind. And, of course, it's all delusion, you know, it's all, you know, but eventually, once you start to recognize it, it begins to settle down at some point. Well, anyway, we have gone over here a little bit. I do want to end these promptly at 9 so I don't hold anybody, but thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.